Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and Dermot Cole of the Alaska Dispatch Anchorage Daily News. Dermot, the Fairbanks Four are not getting a new trial, but they may get a hearing on their much-celebrated case. Remind us, who are the Fairbanks Four and what is in store for them?
Well, Mike, the Fairbanks Four are a group of four young men who have been in prison now for about close to half of their lives. They were convicted in three separate trials going back more than 15 years ago related to the beating death of a young man named John Hartman, who was 15 years old at the time he was killed in 1997. For many years, there have been people in Fairbanks and throughout the interior who have insisted that they were innocent and they were wrongly jailed and wrongly convicted. The latest development began really last fall when the Alaska Innocence Project filed documents in court stating that it had new evidence to show that these men were wrongly convicted. The Alaska Innocence Project is seeking post-conviction relief for the four men. The state has just replied this week with its response to the assertions put forward by the Alaska Innocence Project, basically saying that the state contends that the convictions and the trials were justified, but that because of the polarizing nature of this case, that the legal proceedings should continue. It's sort of a contradictory ruling by the state, position by the state, but it's saying, yes, we believe that that justice was served. However, this is a polarizing case with strong emotions, and that this evidence should be heard, and that the new continued discovery should take place, and that leading ultimately to an evidentiary hearing at which the assertions put forward by the Innocence Project should be heard. And I might just add one more thing, and that is the key evidence put forward by the Alaska Innocence Project are affidavits, one in particular from a man named Holmes, who is serving prison, a double life murder sentence in California. And he asserts that he was the driver of a car and that several other individuals were responsible for the killing. The state has said that Mr. Holmes is not a reliable or credible witness. The Alaska Innocence Project is putting forward his testimony basically to try and free the four men.
Now, one of the things that was sort of confusing to a reader of news stories and listening to the latest developments is, if we do go through with this evidentiary hearing, what are the standards? It's not beyond a reasonable doubt, is it? And what are sort of the rules of evidence? What can be introduced here? Has that been made clear to you?
It has not. And in fact, the statements filed this week by the prosecutors say that this is sort of a new territory. It was a 23-page document that the prosecutors filed this week. And they said that, you know, as this proceeds, a lot of different things will come up. One point the state makes is that there was a lot of evidence, it says, that was suppressed or not allowed to be admitted during the trials of these four men. The state is saying, well, if we're going to bring this up now, that evidence should be allowed as part of the litigation. A lot of this has to be worked out yet, and it's really not clear what's going to happen. One other additional wrinkle is that there is a sealed document that the judge in Fairbanks is now reviewing that somehow, we don't know exactly, but it relates to the man named Wallace, who is believed, asserted by Mr. Holmes, to have been the man mainly responsible for the killing. The sealed document deals with Wallace somehow. We have to wait and see what that document contains before we really have a better picture of what's being put forward here as the reasons for that these men deserve a new look from the justice system.
Now, if the hearing does produce some kind of victory for the defendants in this case, the Fairbanks Four, What would their victory consist of? A new trial? Do you know?
They are seeking a declaration that they are innocent, that you know that this testimony that is going to be put forward, it will show them to be the people who were wrongly convicted.
So they're seeking a dismissal as a result of this process.
That's true. That's correct.
Okay, let's turn to Tim Bradner. Tim, the battle over Senate Bill 21, the Parnell oil tax bill, continues to approach a vote on the referendum to repeal the tax. The opponents led by the oil companies are outspending the advocates something like 40, 50 or more to one. You can't turn on your radio without hearing from them. I've gotten mailers. This seems to have put the other side, even though they just opened their headquarters, those who say report the repeal support the referendum, has put them in a pretty tough place, wouldn't you say?
I would think so, Mike. But you know, we have to remember that when there's such an overwhelming one-sidedness to the funding and the public presence in a campaign like this, it can have a backlash. So I think a lot of this is, you know, what happens in the referendum is really going to depend on how the, you know, vote no campaign manages their campaign. If they appear to be too over the top and too heavy-handed, it could backfire. And I think we, you know, these things can always be surprising. We looked, you know, a lot of this, people point to the Coastal Zone Management Initiative that was well-funded. The opposition vote against the extension of the Coastal Zone Management. The proponents of it had little resources and they lost. But on the other hand, we go back to the cruise ship initiative. The cruise industry had big bucks, big campaign. You know, the advocates for a tax on cruise passengers had little resources. They won. So I think you never know with things
like
this.
Does the fact that this is being held in the August primary appear to favor one party or the other?
I think it probably would in this case, particularly since you had the labor initiatives and the marijuana initiative pushed back to the general election. So those people don't turn up for the August primary. The people who do turn up tend to be super voters. They tend to be older people, you know, usually conservative people.
And the big action is going to be in the Republican U.S. Senate race.
In November.
In August, that's the big draw for this election, it looks like.
Yeah, of course, in that case, that is true. But I think still the environment of it is going to tend to favor more the conservative Republican, vote no campaign. But as I said, it depends on how they run the campaign. It could backfire. It's theirs to lose, I think.
Right. Okay, yeah. Paul, the Flint Hills refinery shutdown continues. Soon enough, there will be no production in North Pole. Have we reached this stage that the only thing left is the finger pointing?
There will be plenty of finger pointing in the coming years. There's disagreement. When Flint Hills bought the refinery in 2004, there was no known problems. I mean, they bought the refinery without knowing there was a sulfalane leak. Nobody now agrees powerful chemical that nobody really can agree how many parts per billion hurt you or doesn't hurt you. It's spreading out from North Pole. It's affecting homes and wells. So, there's going to be a lot of finger pointing. Governor Parnell has tried to absolve anybody who might buy the refinery from having to pay in the future for cleanup costs. The state, there's going to be a settlement at some point or lawsuits over who does have to pay for the cleanup. The plant is being, the refinery itself is being more or less mothballed, not shut down completely forever. To allow a new buyer, there's apparently negotiations. The Koch brothers, who own Flint Hills, own the corporation that owns Flint Hills, are looking for a buyer for it and have been for some time. So it's possible that this could go. They're going to be plagued by the same problems that bothered them before, which is high energy costs to run the plant. They don't have natural gas to run it on North Slope crude oil, which is anywhere from $17 to $30 more expensive than West Texas Intermediate. So you wind up with a very high energy cost there and declining sales. Jet fuel sales to Anchorage International dropped off by half over 10 or 15 years. So they've got they have real problems. Somebody buying that plant would have to really think about what they were
doing. Let's get Tim Bradner briefly.
Oh, Michael, the only observation I was going to make is a lot of people are concerned about, with the refinery going down, that was the big supplier of gasoline and heating oil in Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. Does that mean as oil is going to be shipped in, it's going to be more expensive? And you do hear anecdotes of futures contract prices of fuel being higher, but then also you hear that it's, I've talked to a couple of fuel suppliers up there, and they say it's, yeah, prices are a bit up, but you can't sort it out over whether it's the margin. And Flint Hills still is going to be marketing oil, but they're just not making the oil. But it's also hard to sort out whether it's the higher base price of the crude oil. So it's too early to tell whether it's really going to have a big cost impact or not.
Okay, let's leave it there. Dermot, the SARB. I love that acronym for State Assessment Review Board. The SARB has met in Anchorage to review the assessed value of the pipeline. The players, that is the state, the oil companies, and local communities, have wildly different estimates of the value. Why, and more generally, what transpires at these meetings, parts of which are public and parts not?
Well, the process works like this. The State Department of Revenue sets a tax value for property tax purposes on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and oil facilities every year. And then there's a series of appeals. Generally, the oil companies saying it's too high, and the municipal governments, which make that's a big source of funding for them, saying that it's too low. This year has followed suit. Maybe the one big change this year is that the state Department of Revenue is asserting that the tax value of the pipeline this year is half of what it was last year. And the key element there is that the State Assessment Review Board last year went for a much higher assessed value of the pipeline by billions higher than the Department of Revenue supported. There's been a big conflict between the State Assessment Review Board and the Department of Revenue that goes back over a number of years. The membership of that board, you might recall, changed recently when the former Anchorage assessor, Marty McGee, was fired by Governor Parnell, and his replacement was a man from California. He later withdrew because he wouldn't have been confirmed by the legislature. There is a new appointee to the board, Bernie Washington of Anchorage, and that changes the makeup of the SARB. So what's happening now is that the State Department of Revenue is coming with a much lower starting point for the assessed value of the pipeline. The oil companies still say it's too high. The municipalities say it's too low. It's a very complicated procedure to figure out what the pipeline is worth, as you might imagine. It's not like figuring out how much your house is worth. One argument is the replacement value of the pipeline. Another is the value of the oil it carries and the value of future oil reserves on the North Slope. There's a great deal that's hard to summarize in this format here. But just, I guess, the key thing for Alaskans probably is the to see what the SARB does. It's been meeting all this week in Anchorage. In its decision, will it favor the municipalities, or will, as it has in the past, or will it be closer to what the State Department of Revenue has proposed as an accurate value for the pipeline?
Tim, you wanted to add something?
Just real quick, why this is important is because the state sets the assessed value of the pipeline. The municipalities along the pipeline route, Fairbanks, Valdez, North Slope, have to comply. They have to use that valuation. So it affects their revenues very directly. And I was just going to add, I ducked my head into this hearing this week for a few minutes just to try to get a sense of what was going on. And I got to tell you, these people were, this issue is so complex. This is a different language. But when I looked around that room and I saw this is a huge economic engine for the lawyers, I saw those suits and I could just hear the cash registers ringing, days and days and days of the arguments and counter-arguments of this stuff.
Now, Tim, I wanted to add one thing here. The state sets the rate because they're not going to allow the municipalities to set the rates for fear that they would be, what the argument I think in the past was something like confiscatory.
Many years ago, this goes back to 1973. The law was set up so that the state controlled the assessment, and the concern was that you would have different municipalities with different views of the assessment setting different assessment rates. So the idea was the state would set a uniform assessment, but Even so, the arguments still go on.
Okay. Let's stay with you, Tim. Economist Scott Goldsmith does a study of the economic consequences of Senate Bill 21, the oil tax revision, and concludes the proponents of the bill are essentially right. Tell us more.
Michael, I went to listen to the Scott's presentation, and my takeaway is basically he agreed with the Department of Revenue. Their analysis of the tax impacts, Scott pretty much came down. And I think what was significant is the fact that he did an independent assessment. He went to he looked at all the numbers himself, and he came to basically the same conclusion as the Department of Revenue, that the ACES was not a good idea in the years it was in effect, that it was a good idea to replace it with something more workable. And more interestingly, he found that which the department has also found, that ACES and SB 21 really generated about the same amount of revenue, depending on, there isn't any big giveaway, is the point he was making.
Dermot, you wanted to add something?
Well, Scott's conclusion that the income at current prices and production levels is basically the same as it would be under ACES, I think that's clear, and I agree with it. Probably the big point where I maybe disagreed with him somewhat is that in the discussion leading up to where we are today, a year ago, it was not made clear to Alaskans that this was the situation we were facing. And it, meaning that if prices declined somewhat, production dipped somewhat, and if there was a substantial increase in the cost per barrel of production, that, yeah, it would be a wash between these two tax systems. That's certainly not how it was sold a year ago before the legislature and for Alaskans. I mean, since I've written about this, many people have pointed to various presentations a year ago in which there was a slide here or there or a presentation that says, well, yeah, we did predict that if conditions change, that the amount under ACES would be about the same as SB 21. But that certainly wasn't the thrust of the arguments a year ago. And you might even, even with Paul Jenkins there, for instance, he could talk about a year ago he was writing about the $2 billion, stealing $2 billion from the owners of the oil companies. Well, which is a situation that we are not facing today. I just sort of have a problem with why this wasn't discussed more in advance.
Okay. Paul, advocates of same-sex marriage are in court across much of the nation and now here in Alaska, where there is a lawsuit on behalf of gay Alaskans who wish to be married and can't under our Constitution. Tell us about this suit and its prospects.
Following the Supreme Court's dismantling, if you will, of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, across the country, states have been knocking down bans on gay marriage. In Alaska, we've got five couples that are challenging the 1998 definition of marriage as a man and a woman. They're claiming that their constitutional protections in the 14th Amendment are being abridged. These are people of a varied background, disparate backgrounds, different experiences, different circumstances. All in all, they seem dedicated to taking this all the way through the appeals process if they were to lose. I don't know. The Alaska Supreme Court has already started to nibble away at laws that seem to discriminate against gays in the state as far as benefits for spousal benefits and tax benefits and property tax benefits. So I don't know how they'll fare in court, but it's going to be a pretty important case.
Do we have any sense of how long this process might take?
In Alaska, forever. I don't know. It could go on for quite a while.
Okay. Tim, you report that bidding was modest at the state's annual Cook Inlet and Alaska Peninsula lease sale for the oil and gas industry. Explain.
Michael, this sale is held every year by the state. It's a so-called area-wide sale where they offer up all the unleased acreage. It's considered kind of a barometer of interest because you see how many companies are bidding and who's bidding. And this year the bidding was modest, but it was still significant in that the two companies that picked up most of the acreage are really three companies, well, really four. Hillcorp and Apache Oil picked up most of the new leases. And why that's important is because it demonstrates a courage and continuing commitment by those companies which are now making a pretty heavy investment in Cook Inlet. So it shows that they're still optimistic about the inlet and they're willing to put more money in. Other companies have picked up some acreage. Cook Inlet Energy, a small company that's producing now on the west side, picked up 4 leases. That shows continued commitment. Nordac Energy, a small local independent, picked up acreage. They're drilling on the Kenai Peninsula. That shows continued interest. So all that's healthy. That, you know, it's good. It's good news for us, I think.
And what is the tax regimen like for oil, for gas in particular, in Cook Inlet? It's
well, gas is a bit complicated, but oil, there's essentially no tax in Cook Inlet. There hasn't been for years. That started because, you know, legislators, you know, were interested in getting the taxes high on the North Slope, but Cook Inlet needed help, small fields and that sort of thing, more jobs at stake then. And they lowered the taxes in Cook Inlet, where essentially now there's no oil taxes. There is still a small tax on the gas, though.
Okay. Paul, voting rights lawyers and their allies have filed a suit charging that the state has failed to adequately translate the ballots in our elections, the ballot information accompanying ballot propositions specifically, into native language and dialects, that the voters cannot understand what the state is putting before them, allegedly in their own tongue. What is the detail of this complaint?
Well, Yupik speakers, Kupik and Gwich'in speakers are claiming that the state is not translating into their languages the voting documents. The state says no. We're complying with the Voting Rights Act. We've got outreach, bilingual poll workers, and translated booklets and translated documents. But a researcher from the University of Alaska who looked at the documents and tried to, he speaks Yupik, and was trying to actually use the state's documents, had a difficult time understanding them. So there's some debate about whether the documents were properly translated or not. So I think we're in court now. It's a Voting Rights Act violation allegation, and it goes to how well the translation went, I think.
What I'm wondering is this case or this suit was filed 3 months before a primary election, so
politics?
The outcome of this is not going to affect the ballot, the referendum on oil taxes, and it's unlikely that this could be decided, if it's appealed, it's very unlikely to be decided by the November election. So I assume this is prospective, and is there any penalty here other than telling the state to go and straighten out their translations?
I'm not sure if there's a federal penalty or not, to be frank with you, but I doubt there is. They would probably just be forced to do it at great expense to the state, of course, but whether they'll be forced to do it, I don't know.
Okay. Dermot, turning back to you, 2 Alaska State Troopers died during an arrest in Tanana. This is very well known at this point. The tragedy not only had a profound effect on the village, but also on the city of Fairbanks, where the troopers were based. A memorial service recently drew 4,000 people. You attended. What did you see?
Mike, I think this was one of the largest funerals ever held in Fairbanks. It was a somber, you know, and at times sort of joyous event in a sense, celebrating the lives of Scott Johnson and Gabe Rich. There were hundreds of law enforcement officers from across the state and from many states around the country, Florida. There were some Canadian Mounties. They were from the Northwest, all over, people who were here. This is sort of an unspeakable, unexplainable tragedy, and that's sort of maybe how members of the audience felt listening to the life stories of these men. One of the particularly touching moments was when the widow of Trooper Johnson and his oldest daughter, both spoke eloquently, I thought, about his life and how they will, try to do their best to get along without him. This did have a deep impact in Fairbanks, in part because both these men had spent most of their lives in this area and in the interior. Johnson grew up in Tok, and Gabe Rich grew up in Fairbanks.
And if I might just interrupt you briefly, you've written about this publicly. You knew one of the troopers, and you've talked about him in print, or had known him.
Well, Gabe Rich is the same age as one of my oldest daughter, and actually I coached him in soccer. I mean, I wasn't a very good coach, and this was the under six soccer team, but he was on the first soccer team I coached for my daughter here. And I kept track of him throughout the years, and he became a North Pole policeman and then a trooper. He was he had a very good reputation, not only among his peers, but also among the public at large. He was on the Alaska State Troopers National Geographic TV show quite often. And he had both of these men had a fairly strong reputations, and their loss is really being felt here. It's an acute sense that, how could this happen? They're responding to something that ordinarily would go without a hitch, and here it is. They give their lives. So
we're going to have to leave it there, and I will thank you for that personal report, Dermot, and thank you to the rest of my colleagues for joining me on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.